This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Senators, the Sabres, and the Rangers, the Canucks, are glad they're back to dropping gloves and sometimes shooting pucks. The Red Wings, likewise, are delighted, and the Hurricanes. But pity poor St. Louis, where the losses mount. The gains are likewise sparse in Pittsburgh. In those cities, now it's clear, the greatest present would have been to miss another year. Joining me now to discuss the National Hockey League as the year prepares to turn is Helene Elliott, who writes about pro hockey for the L.A. Times. Helene, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you.
The Ottawa Senators, fervent suitors of Stanley's Cup in the recent past, are making a serious run at it again, or they appear to be, currently one of the best teams in the league. Will they still be in April?
That's the question of the hour, of the day, of the month, of the year. The knock on the Senators has always been that they didn't have the toughness to last in the playoffs and that they didn't have the goaltending. And right now, they certainly have the goaltending. Dominic Hasek has been having an incredible season, and they have been showing some toughness along the way as well. So I think their prospects are looking a little bit better.
What about the Rangers? Until very recently, one of the league's worst teams, despite spending more money than anybody else, and now they're up among the elite again. Is this the result of the Rangers' newfound, albeit league-imposed, frugality?
It was just that Glenn Sather was fooling us all those years. He was always a genius. He was just trying to fool people by missing the playoffs the previous seven seasons. You know, I think it's just an incredible story that, you know, here the rules change and it's supposedly going to hurt the Rangers and make it more difficult for them. And here they are going with kids and everybody thinking, well, this is really a throwaway year. They're not going to do anything. And here they are doing very well. It's really pretty astonishing. I mean, this kid Peter Peruka has been terrific, and Jaromir Jagr has really been energized by the new rules. And he's able to skate. He can score off the rush. He's been having a tremendous season.
The Nashville Predators, the Vancouver Canucks, never strangers to thrift, have posted impressive records. Does this all suggest that the Western Conference playoff picture, once monopolized by Detroit, Colorado, Dallas, is going to look real different this time around?
That is a very good question, too. Boy, you're full of good questions today. I'm so impressed.
That's my end-of-the-year burst of hockey energy. I don't know how else to explain it.
It must be. Nashville has been one of the biggest surprises this year because they have the speed. They've had the goaltending. Thomas Vokoun has been absolutely terrific. You know, they did make the playoffs the year before the lockout. People kind of forget that. They have some of the essential ingredients there. I think that they still need to be playoff tested, kind of. And I still would put a lot of faith in Detroit being there late in the playoffs this year as well. I mean, you know, people looked at them this year and said they're going to be hurt by the new rules because they're old and they're slow. And, you know, Chris Chelios is 112 or whatever he is at this point. But, excuse me, okay, only 44. But they've adapted very, very well. They've gotten a lot of great stuff out of Pavel Datsyuk and Zetterberg and some other people who I never really expected would do all that much. I think the big question with them remains the goaltending. But they've been a tremendous surprise and they've adapted very, very well.
Helene, before the recent limits on payroll, some fans griped that the teams north of the border were at a disadvantage because of a stronger U.S. dollar, and of course, owners who had more dollars anyway. Has the hard salary cap made Canadians happier?
I think it has. I mean, you look at the status of all the Canadian teams right now, and they're all either in a playoff position or very close to it. I mean, certainly Ottawa has not been hurt by it. Montreal, Vancouver is having a strong season. I mean, Toronto, whatever faults they have nothing to do with the salary cap. It's management there. Plus, you know, the Canadian dollar has been a little stronger, so that's helped those teams. Hmm. But, you know, the salary cap has not had a bad effect on them at all.
Helene, right after this season began, attendance was pretty good in the NHL. Is it still strong at this point in the season? And if so, does it vindicate the owners who had been criticized for killing off the 2004-2005 season?
Well, I don't know if you've been to the same rinks I've been to or maybe seen games on TV where they'll announce, you know, 17,000 in a rink, and you'll see all these thousands of empty seats and go, excuse me, but where are they coming up with that number? But, you know, attendance wasn't ever really the NHL's biggest problem. You know, there were always cities where it was down, or, you know, it was cyclical, where a team would win, it would go up, the team would have a few bad years, it would go down, but it would come back. But, you know, the NHL's big problem was always the TV money and TV exposure and merchandising and marketing revenues, and I'm not sure how much those have increased.
The USA's Olympic hockey roster was announced on Monday. Will this year's Team USA be able to avoid debacles similar to what occurred in Nagano and in Salt Lake City?
Well, I certainly hope those chairs are a little less flimsy than they were in Nagano.
I wasn't referring to the damage they did to the hotel rooms. Let's stick to the ice here.
Oh, I thought that was an oblique reference there. I thought I was being so clever, too. You know, I was listening to the announcement of the roster the other day, and thinking, wow, you know, it used to be that the U.S. was so strong in goal and on defense, and to me, those are weaknesses this time around. Rick DiPietro, the day that they announced that he was picked, gave up 6 goals in something like 17 minutes. That's not a good omen. Defense, Darian Hatcher is kind of old and slow, and you're asking him to cover a lot of ice. You know, the international rinks are 15 feet wider than NHL rinks. I think this team could have some problems.
Team Canada announced its Olympic squad as well on Wednesday. You pick which surprise you want to talk about on that one.
You know, people were suggesting that Sidney Crosby should be part of the team, and I truly think he should be. This kid is probably the best thing that's happened to hockey in decades, and they left him off because he wasn't on the World Cup team 2 years ago or the World Championships team. Well, you know, experience isn't the only factor here. I mean, this kid has a wow factor. Seriously. And he's played in the World Junior Championships and shown he can handle the pressure. Why not include him? Why not let him get the experience now? And then in 2010, when the games were in Vancouver, he would be incredibly well-positioned to be a leader.
Helene Elliott covers the world's coolest game for the Times of Los Angeles. She is also Only a Games Herald of the Hockey Holidays. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
So lower your high stick and remember jolly old Saint Nick. Hey, you big idiot. Happy holidays.
Until very recently, the sad sack of the NFL, resurgent Cincinnati is 11-3, good enough to clinch first place in the AFC North. The Bengals will participate in the NFL postseason for the first time in 15 years. As Ron Schachter reports, that's a welcome prospect for the team formerly known as the Bungles.
In 14 games this season, Bengals quarterback Carson Palmer has thrown for 3,500 yards, 30 touchdowns, and only 10 interceptions. Numbers almost identical to those of Indianapolis Colts quarterback Peyton Manning. The two matched each other strike for strike in the Colts' 45-37 win last month. And lately, Palmer has excelled at running a no-huddle offense and calling plays at the line of scrimmage, Manning's trademark. What's more remarkable, says Bengals wide receiver Chad Johnson, is that Palmer is just finishing his second season as the Bengals' starting quarterback.
The real deal. We all knew he was good, but we didn't know he'd be this good this early.
Palmer actually arrived 3 years ago from USC as the first overall pick in the NFL draft. But Cincinnati coach Marvin Lewis let him learn from the sidelines during his first pro season. That was just one of Lewis's successful strategies, says the Cincinnati Inquirer's Mark Cornut, who's covered the team for 6 years.
He came in here with a very specific plan. He's brought in, again, while all the players are different personalities, different skill sets, there's a commonality to them that they're all very professional. The free agents that he brought in from other NFL teams all had been with winning clubs. The younger players have all come from winning college programs.
Lewis, now in his third season, inherited a Bengals team that had gone 2-14 in 2002 and immediately brought them back to respectability with consecutive 8-8 seasons. This season, the Bengals boast an offensive attack that features running back Rudy Johnson, who's already passed 1,300 yards rushing, and Palmer's favorite target Chad Johnson, who's caught 8 touchdown passes for better than 1,200 yards. Chad Johnson says that combination bedevils Bengals opponents.
I call it a pick-your-poison offense. You want to stop the run, you know, you die with the pass. You know, you want to stop the pass, and you die with the run. Either way it goes, you're going to lose. I can't spell it, but we're a juggernaut.
The defense has pitched in as well, snatching a league-leading 30 interceptions and causing 26 more turnovers than the Cincinnati offense has given up. Quarterback Palmer says those numbers make a big difference.
Offensively, when you have to go a short field, when you don't have to worry about going 80, 85 yards to score, and you got the ball back on first down, you already got a field goal. I mean, that's tremendous. If our defense can keep doing that, it makes offensively our jobs a lot easier.
The Bengals earned their playoff berth last Sunday when they defeated the Detroit Lions to claim the AFC North title ahead of the Pittsburgh Steelers. That accomplishment prompted offensive lineman and 10-year Bengals veteran Willie Anderson to exclaim, "Even a garbage can gets a steak now and then." Anderson says that in his early years, winning did not seem to be an option.
If you have over 60%, 70% of guys that really not giving a hoot about winning, that's going to spoil your team. And the whole organization, how we were set up, organized, just wasn't right either. I mean, as far as we know with the coaching, what kind of coaching we were getting, you know, the strategy we have for each game plan and how we attacked opponents and how we viewed other teams, it just wasn't the same as it is right now.
There's been a noticeable change in the fans as well. Reporter Mark Cornute remembers the days when the Bengals' home games looked more like away games.
You would see a lot of Cleveland Browns jerseys, brown as opposed to black, which is the Bengals' other primary color. When you would really notice it would be Pittsburgh week. And you would see all the terrible towels, the gold terrible towels. You would see the Jerome Bettis jerseys, the Joey Porter jerseys, all the black and gold. There'd be a lot of cheering when Pittsburgh scored, and there'd be a lot of cheering when Cincinnati would make a turnover. And it was always just convoluted.
Since their turnaround, Bengals Black and Orange has provided a makeover for Paul Brown Stadium. The team has sold out 19 consecutive home games, including today's contest against the Buffalo Bills. The Bengals will finish the regular season next week at Kansas City. And now, all they really want for Christmas is enough wins to secure a first-round bye in the AFC playoffs, which begin on January 7th. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Cincinnati.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Canyon's great, if not grand. But first, since 1991, Glenn Stout has been presiding over the assembly of an annual volume entitled Best American Sports Writing. Mike Lupica is the guest editor of the most recent edition of this venerable tome, which includes a terrific story by longtime New York Times columnist and feature writer Ira Burko. Glenn Stout joins me now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Glenn, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
And Ira Burko joins us from New York. Ira, it's great to have you on the program again.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you. It's good to be back with you.
Ira, your story is about reconnecting with a pitcher whom you'd known back when you were still a prospect, and it ends with the validating of a memory of an unlikely moment of brilliance. Tell us about that.
I was only a prospect in my head until I was about 10 years old, This was a story about a guy who I played in the Little League against, Pony League, and in high school. His name was Jim Woods, and he was just a great athlete. He wasn't like a great physical specimen, a normal kind of looking person, redhead, freckles. But he just had this a great hand-eye coordination, and he was blessed. I played against him in high school in June of 1957, and he pitched against us, but he was also a great hitter. And he was signed and went immediately from the Sandlots to Wrigley Field, and he joined the Cubs, mm-hmm. Which was just an amazing thing. He's 17 years old, and suddenly he's with the Cubs. And it turns out that he played very little for the Cubs and then was traded a few years later when he was in the minor leagues to the Phillies. But he was my connection to the major leagues. He was a guy who I played against, and as I wrote in the piece, there, but for the grace of God and talent and skill and maybe brains go I, you know. But he had it all. He had it. And the striking thing is that when I pitched against him in the Woods in the Pony League, and we were 14 years old, and he hit a home run that must have gone 600 feet. It went over buildings. It went over trees. It went over railroads. It was an amazing hit. And I was looking for him for a number of years, to see what happened to him, and I finally found him. He was living in California. He had worked for the airlines, and it was a sort of minor kind of work, but he was living a pretty good life. He was married, had a couple kids. And then he had told me that one of the highlights of his major league career was when he pinch hit against Sandy Koufax in the Los Angeles Coliseum, and they had a huge screen up in left field, 42 feet high. And he said he crushed one against Sandy Koufax that should have been a home run. It seemed that it was the same kind of crushing that he did against me. But I end the piece thinking about Koufax and me, and the hit that the hits that Woods got off both him and me, and I thought, you know, I'm in pretty good company.
Well, it feels to me as if this story stands out in the current collection because it's in the company of so many stories about steroids and athletes abusing other drugs and athletes abusing women, not to mention tales of hideous illnesses suffered by athletes. Glenn, was it a particularly grim year?
Well, I don't think it was a particularly grim year, although I think in any given year these days, there are always grim stories in sports. But what makes a story like Ira's stand out, besides the fact that it's not grim, for me anyway at least, was that I think many of us who have played sports at any level have always looked to that connection to someone who actually did succeed, because let's face it, we were all failures. And I think just about anybody who played has that story of the guy they played against that maybe didn't make the major leagues, but maybe ended up being a college star or something like that. So even though Ira's story is very specific to his own experience, it's got that, oh yeah, I know what he means feel to it that everyone can relate to.
You know, if I may interject here, the best stories are dramas. Boxing, for example, which probably should be eliminated from any world sport in civilized society, also points up some primal drive or urge that all of us have, because there is something compelling about boxing, and some of the greatest sports writing in the past and currently is about boxing, because every time a boxer gets into the ring, he may not survive. And somewhere in our subconscious, at least, all of us know this, and this adds to the drama, and then it adds to the writing on a sport like boxing.
Steve Cole's story about the ways in which the administration and the military tried to capitalize on the death of Pat Tillman, former professional football player who enlisted to go to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, was that one of the first stories to make the cut, Glenn?
You know, it was in my mind simply because it was such a great job of reporting about someone who had been, you know, really lionized and over-lionized. Not that Tillman did not deserve it for the sacrifice that he gave, but the way the story had been twisted and taken and really diminished what he did. And I thought that Stephen Cole's story, by explaining what actually happened, in a sense, restored Tillman to the guy he was rather than this figure that other people wanted him to be. And, you know, it was just very, very affecting. And given, you know, the political climate right now and that the war is a topic, I thought that that story was a no-brainer. And fortunately, Mike Lupica seemed to agree with me.
There are often stories about sports or alleged sports with which many readers may be unfamiliar in these collections. Glenn, have you had many letters from people contending that shooting at fish with guns is not really a sport?
Not a single one, particularly here in Vermont.
Where they do that thing.
That was my dark horse favorite from the moment I read it, because for parochial reasons, obviously, because it takes place only a few miles from my house, but it was also something that I had never heard of. And when I first read the story, I thought it was a joke. I thought, surely, there's nowhere in this world where they let people shoot fish with guns. But they do. And Pam Bellick's story, which came from the New York Times, was written so straightforwardly that there was no cynicism in it whatsoever. It just let the story unfold, and I think gets you a real sense of why these people actually go out and do it and why they feel that it's the most normal thing in the world. And I think one of the things this book does is it is able to present to readers, you know, something that they have never heard of before and present it in context as to why it happens at all.
One of the stories involving females this time around is about a dance team called the Rangerettes. Another is about three women who got raped by a baseball player. A third is about a female basketball player struck down by a terrible disease. In 2005, where are the stories about women as athletes rather than women as entertainers or women as victims?
Well, I think in some people's minds, particularly in the case of the story about the Rangerettes down in Texas, they look at themselves as athletes. And in that context, they see themselves as athletes. But in a larger sense, I think you do have a point. You know, it is we've had the explosion of women's soccer in the United States and the professional soccer league, which is now gone by the wayside. You know, female athletes, I think, don't seem to be getting, even though there are more opportunities now, they don't seem to be getting the same amount of attention. In a way, because there is a WNBA and there was a women's professional soccer league, in a way that's given people an opportunity to marginalize those athletes and to put them in that niche. They have a place now. Perhaps they're not as worth writing about as they were before they had the professional outlets.
Glenn, Ira brings up the importance of drama to the success of any story, and since this volume covers the autumn in which the Red Sox won the World Series, the ultimate drama, of course, there had to be a story about that remarkable occurrence. It comes courtesy of Tom Verducci. But is there a great sports-related story that isn't covered, that's missing from the 2005 edition of Best American Sports Writing?
Well, I think depending on, you know, where a person sits and roots, there are probably a lot of people that think we missed a great story in any given year. But that's not really part of the criteria. You know, sometimes I think it's difficult for the great stories to necessarily spawn great writing. There is one Red Sox story in the book. A lot of people, particularly in the Northeast and in New England, think that the book should be nothing but stories about the Red Sox. But with the exception of just a few things that I read, I don't think that event spawned any great writing. You know, getting back to what Ira says in a little bit, where the best writing has some drama in it, well, drama is best expressed in stories about loss, not victory. And in the case of the Red Sox, I think so many writers were so giddy about the entire experience that they didn't really write very much that's very memorable.
Ira, do you feel as if this volume is missing anything? I mean, you open it up and look at it and say, well, yeah, gee, but there really ought to be a story about X.
Well, I had another good story I thought I wrote this year.
What a writer!
That's the kind of honesty we like to hear.
I don't remember what it was, but I'm sure I did.
Ira Berko's Making Contact is featured in Best American Sports Writing 2005, published by Houghton Mifflin. He joined me from New York. Ira, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
And Glenn Stout is the series editor for Best American Sports Writing. He joined me from Vermont Public Radio. Glenn, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Part sport, part adventure, canyoneering involves hiking, swimming, rappelling, and a bit of ingenuity. Its popularity continues to grow, especially in the Southwest, where sandstone slots and deep gorges are some of the sport's premier destinations. Author Tyler Williams has written two guidebooks about Arizona's canyons. He recently took a day trip down James Canyon and invited along Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker, who produced this audio postcard.
First, a disclaimer. I bought Williams' book Canyoneering Arizona when I moved to the state, and it's now in tatters from overuse. But this canyon is new for me. As Williams explains, it's considered technical.
There's challenge to it. There's down climbs. There's rappels, you know.
Which means you need specialized equipment and expertise to descend it. I have neither, so I'm glad Williams is leading me through it. It doesn't take long for sandstone walls to close in on either side of us. It's mid-morning when we reach our first obstacle.
We've got to get wet already.
Here the canyon narrows into a long, very wet-looking pool. Williams drops in first. My wife Erin and our friend Sue follow.
No screams?
No screams. Nice though.
Tyler drains the water out of his backpack through holes in the bottom. By now, the sun has risen high in the summer sky.
How beautiful that is.
Yellow columbines drape down the sandstone walls on both sides of the pool. This is exactly what drew me to Arizona's canyons in the first place. The solitude, the deep, cool pools defying the hot desert sun. But soon we reach our second obstacle, and this is a perfect example of what has prevented me from exploring more of Arizona's canyons.
There's this little narrows here with two potholes incised in the sandstone, which I think is going to be the trickiest part because sometimes you get down into those things and you can't get out of them.
Sounds inviting. Here, James Canyon dives down about 12 feet into a little slot. The potholes carved into the sandstone by centuries of spring runoff look like gigantic teacups filled with murky water. Sue asked the question both Erin and I have been wondering.
Tyler, how are we getting down there?
We're going to wrap right over here.
By wrap, Tyler means rappel. He suggests we descend Batman style, meaning without a harness. He feeds a rope through a carabiner that's anchored to a small tree and leans back over the edge.
You know, make sure you don't let go of one of these ropes or you'll just pull through, right? Wow, this is a really cool pothole.
Sue goes next, then gives Erin some coaching.
It was a little scary because I let my legs get too far below me. Keep your weight in your butt.
Just lean out and walk down the wall back.
Yeah, like this? Yep.
I go last, a little nervous but giddy with excitement. At the bottom, I pull the rope down behind me. Tyler says spots like these, where the canyon narrows and drops and twists, are what attracted him to canyoneering.
You get to these places that are just so surreal almost. Places where mammals, us included, don't really go. You know, in these narrow slots where there's waterfalls on either side of you maybe. It's such a cool environment to be down in this place that few people get to see.
As we descend the canyon, its walls widen and narrow. Shade gives way to sunlight. Hot alternates with very cold.
It's freezing!
Here the canyon gets so narrow I can reach out and touch both sides. The water slowly gets deeper and deeper until you're forced to take the plunge. The canyon dries out long enough to bake us dry. We're all quiet. I'm immersed in that feeling I only get when I'm in wilderness, that feeling of being truly alone. I wonder about the last time another human stepped over these same stones. And I ask Williams if his guidebooks could have a negative impact on unspoiled places like James Canyon.
I mean, people generally, they don't make any place more pristine, you know? And I think it's cool to get people out and to get people experiencing these places and hopefully, you know, drawing a connection to nature, and that'll transfer over into other aspects of your life too. I think that's a positive thing. But, you know, we make impacts out here, so you have to be really wary of that.
Just before lunch, the canyon opens up at a huge waterfall, some 40 feet straight down.
On with the harnesses!
After a quick lesson from Tyler, we all rappel down safely.
Don't forget to look down when you're going. It's a great view.
Tyler unclips his carabiner and pulls the rope down. He remembers his first canyoneering trip as a teenager, not far from here.
Then we got to a spot where there was a rock trapped in the narrows, and you had to slide down it to continue downstream, and like idiots, that's of course what we did. We just slid down this thing, and then of course as soon as we turned the next corner, there was a 50-foot waterfall and then 100-foot right below that. And so we were trapped. We thought we were stuck in there. Fortunately, we found an old rotting log that we chalked against the side of the rock that we'd slid down, and we were able to make a desperate climb out of there.
That place he was nearly stuck, Williams calls the tomb, but he says that death mission got him hooked on canyoneering. And after descending James Canyon, I think I might be too. For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker, just south of Flagstaff, Arizona.
How deep is it? That was good timing.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, I got the horse right here. His name is Rudy. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Merry Christmas, Bill.
Merry Christmas to you, sir. Bowl season is rolling.
Of course it is. It's Christmas.
Which ones have you been following?
I have been following nothing so far. It did come to my attention that the United States Naval Academy put 51 on the Colorado State Rams in the poinsettia bowl. And poinsettias, as we now know, Bill, are not poisonous.
And we'll have no calls and no letters this week, I'm sure.
But that's a terrific performance. It's their third. It's the third time in a row they've been in a bowl game. And Reggie Campbell is now one of only 4 players to score 5 touchdowns in a bowl game. So good for him.
Which of next week's bowls will you be watching?
Well, as you know, Christmas Eve is enlivened by the Sheraton Hawaii Bowl between Nevada and the University of Central Florida. I wonder if the Sheraton Hawaii has, like, a ballroom big enough to hold the game. But, every year, I look to see how the National College Football Powers have chosen to celebrate my birthday. And this year, I have the MPC Computer Bowl featuring Boise State and our hometown Boston College Eagles. Mm-hmm. And the MasterCard Alamo Bowl featuring Michigan and Nebraska, who I suspect never dreamed they'd both be playing each other on December 28th.
2 sponsors, not just one, but 2. Joe Paterno was named College Football Coach of the Year this week by the AP. What sort of odds do you think you might have gotten a year ago on that development?
Well, a month ago, you'd have gotten no odds at all because he's been the odds-on choice ever since they won 2 games in a row. He's had a great year, 10-1. He won a piece of the Big Ten title, and he's Joe Paterno. So there's no way anybody else had a chance.
According to the NCAA, USC quarterback Matt Leinart's appearance in an ESPN promo was, quote, unintentional and inadvertent, and so he will not be ruled ineligible to play. Can you explain this curious explanation?
Yes, Matt Leinart is not a third-string point guard for the University of Minnesota at nowhere, and he's somebody the NCAA and its affiliate members need for their big college football television extravaganza in a week or 10 days, so he will be playing without any problems.
So that creaking sound I'm hearing is the bending of a rule.
The creaking sound you're hearing is the snapping of a rule in two and having the pieces hung up on the wall, yes.
Charlie, baseball teams sign free agents all the time, but one particular signing this week caused extraordinary consternation in Boston and considerable gloating in New York City.
Johnny Damon has become a Yankee, has conformed to the team's dress code, so he no longer looks like somebody who flunked the audition to Blue Oyster Cult. And more to the point, the Red Sox have now lost their leadoff hitter, and since they seem bound and determined to peddle Manny Ramirez out of town for a bag of magic beans, I wonder if David Ortiz is having a Merry Christmas, having lost his table setter and facing the loss of his protection in the lineup.
Former East German swimmer Petra Schneider has requested that her 1982 German record in the 400-meter medley be taken off the books because she was taking banned substances. Why the sudden attack of honesty?
Well, I think good for her. I mean, I think if she's trying to make amends for all of this, and God knows she was as much of a victim as the people who lost medals to her since she was being force-fed these drugs without being told what they are, informed consent being a relative concept in East Germany's sports and medicine program. I'm glad she's doing it. I hope they go along with it, and I hope other people follow her lead.
Charlie, next spring the WNBA will have a consistent night of its own. It'll be Tuesday night. In the industry, they call this appointment viewing. Is it an indication of the growth of the popularity of the WNBA?
It's an indication of people having broadcast band to fill and time to fill and wanting to put sports on it because that's what we do in this country. ESPN2 is going to have 14 games on Tuesday night, including 5 doubleheaders. We will have Lindsey Whalen and the Connecticut Sun against the Minnesota Lynx, and we've got Cheryl Swopes and the Houston Comets against Sue Bird and the Seattle Storm. All that note on opening Tuesday night on May 23rd, which I know you've already penciled in.
Dave Cowan's coaching for Chicago. I wouldn't miss it. The announcing of a roster always dismays somebody, and the announcement this week of who will be playing men's hockey for the U.S. at the Olympics in Turin was no exception. Is the U.S. sending the best possible team?
I think they are, by and large. I mean, Brian Leach was on 3 Olympic teams, and he missed, but he's been hurt this year. I mean, it's entirely possible that he should have gone on as kind of a gold watch thing. But otherwise, you've got the usual suspects. You've got Chris Chelios on there, and your goalies are Rick DiPietro and Robert Esch and John Graham. They're all pretty good. You know, Scott Gomez, Billy Guerin, Mike Knuble, a lot of ex-Boston Bruins, oddly enough.
Ex.
Who are playing elsewhere. I think, by and large, the American committee did a fine job, as opposed to the fistfight that's breaking out north of the border.
Well, I was going to say, Penguins phenom Sidney Crosby was not named to Team Canada. Has he not been sufficiently phenomenal in his first NHL semester?
Look, Bill, what do you want in the pool for the date on which some veteran player's back injury requires him to absent himself for the Olympics, and Sidney leaps over the other two alternates and makes a team? I'll take January 13th. But a situation more interesting than why Sidney Crosby isn't on the Olympic team is why Todd Bertuzzi is. I don't know what the – I mean, I'm all in favor of second chances, but the Canadian committee has got to know that they're just asking for 9,000 viewings of that awful piece of videotape where Todd Bertuzzi blindsided Steve Moore and damn near killed him. Now, why they want this kind of publicity nightmare for 13 days is anybody's guess.
Sergeant First Class Joseph Williams, serving in Iraq, was named Track and Field's Athlete of the Week in connection with the Honolulu Marathon. How did he do that?
Well, they put together a marathon in Baghdad, a satellite marathon, and Sergeant Williams finished in 2 hours, 59 minutes, and 57 seconds. Lieutenant Lauren Coban, by the way, of the 101st Airborne, won the women's race in 3 hours, 38 minutes and 30 seconds. This was coordinated to be part of the Honolulu Marathon, but the Baghdad portion of the Honolulu Marathon, if I may use the phrase, was postponed because the Honolulu Marathon was run the same day as the Iraqi elections.
I bet they both would have run faster if they got to go to Honolulu for winning. Lots of people get tired of their jobs. Not many of them respond to the malaise as Craig Holcomb did. You want to take it from there?
Well, he decided he was going to run some marathons. So he's pursuing a goal of running 50 marathons in 50 states, and he managed to do it. He did it, oddly enough, in 50 weeks. He started in January 2nd in Mobile and ended last Sunday in South Carolina. He ran 48 marathons and 2 ultra marathons in all, which is a lot of miles. And I would guarantee you that even if he hangs his stockings by the chimney with care, you probably don't want to get anywhere near them.
And finally, Charlie, Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chad Johnson, famous for his end zone dances, is promising to top all previous celebrations this week. Have you any idea what he has in mind?
Well, he claims that he's I don't believe I'm reading this story. He slightly injured a deer with his car and has been nursing the deer back to health in his garage and is now going to unleash it as part of his end zone celebration. Please, Buffalo Bills, your season is over anyway. Let the man score to see if he brought it.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history.
On Tuesday afternoon, a cold and windy one, Rudy, the former racehorse, is socializing in a corral behind a house in Littleton, Massachusetts, about half an hour west of Boston. Rudy's frisky and looks about halfway toward fat. He seems happy. Maybe that's because he's figured out that nobody's ever again going to ask him to run around a track more quickly than any of the other horses can do it. According to Ellen O'Brien, the executive director of Canter, an organization that places retired racehorses in New England, Rudy just wasn't very good at that.
Rudy started a grand total of 24 times. He was a New York bred. He's actually named after his breeder, Rudy Santopietro. And Rudy was a hopeless racehorse. He never broke his maiden.
In layman's terms, that means Rudy never won a race. He did manage a little over $3,000 worth of thirds and seconds over the course of 3 years at Suffolk Downs, the track in East Boston where Ellen O'Brien collects most of her rejected runners. But O'Brien says that wasn't nearly enough for Rudy's trainer, who's presently working a part-time job in the Santa photo booth at a mall to make up what she's losing training horses like Rudy.
When you're racing at Suffolk Downs, which is a bottom claimer track, I think third, you net about $650. So by the time you've paid the trainer and the jockey and the veterinarian for administering the medication, I think you walk away with about $250. So,
which will feed a horse for about 3 days.
Actually, at the track, yeah, if you pay a day rate of about $40 or $50, it's not even a week's worth of board. So Rudy certainly wasn't a money-making proposition, I will say that.
Rudy is just the sort of horse Ellen O'Brien seeks. Slow enough to be a candidate for destruction, cute enough to appeal to a foster parent.
You know, the guys will sell the horses sometimes for $200 because it means literally, you know, I had one guy at the Northampton Fair say to me, that means that I can sleep in a hotel for two nights, I can do my laundry, I can get a hot meal, and I can get a bottle of booze. So, you know, people think, they watch the Kentucky Derby and they think that's horse racing, and unfortunately it's a much wider spectrum than that.
At the wrong end of the wide spectrum are horses like Rudy, handsome, playful, hungry, slow, and doomed unless Ellen O'Brien or somebody like her intervenes to make the acquaintance of the man in the black wagon.
Well, we all know who they are. I mean, everybody at the track will say, you know, there's the meat guy. And, you know, I know his truck and trailer. I have to deal with him all the time. We've actually bought a horse off his truck once.
You mean the horse was on his way to be dog food and you...
We were at the Northampton Fair. And, you know, typically we have two or three weekends, and there's 100, 250 horses there. And at the end of it, most of them have to go, is quote unquote, is what the trainers will say. And you know who's going to pick them up if we don't. And it was a mad scramble, and after the last race and the last day, and it's pitch black, it's about 6 o'clock, and we had literally been up for 36 hours, somebody looked up and said, oh my God, there he goes, he's got a horse in his truck. And one of my volunteers literally jumped in front of his truck as he was pulling up the gate and said, stop, what have you got, we'll buy it from you. And the horse had bowed a tendon in the last race, was put on the truck hot, no medication, no nothing, and we bought the horse off the truck. But she would have otherwise made a 12-hour trip to a kill pen.
For a horse like that one, Cantor's triumph is in saving the animal from pain. It's a triumph that comes with a price tag. Horses don't stop eating after they're saved. As they recover from the mistreatment they're likely to have suffered in the cellar of the racing world, they also need medical care, room to run, and other horses with which they can socialize. But Ellen O'Brien says nobody should assume every reclaimed racehorse is a charity case.
People have to get the idea out of their head that a rescue horse means that a horse is going to be sort of walk, trot, cripple its whole life. A lot of these horses come off the track and go on to great careers. In fact, back in the 90s, the bronze medalist in eventing at the Olympics was a horse that retired from Suffolk Downs at the age of 7. But, when I tell people that, they're amazed. How could a horse at Suffolk Downs went to the Olympics? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, I can't take you down there and show you 10 of them right now, but the rescue horses that we take on have a range of abilities, and a lot of times it's just finding a place to put them for them to get care, for them to let down, and for them to start learning a new life.
Rudy's learning his new life under the supervision of Christine Field, who owns the yard in Littleton around which he's running. Rudy's company includes half a dozen other horses. Christine Field says they are at once a necessity and a challenge for Rudy.
He doesn't really know how to be a horse yet, you know, because he hasn't lived with other horses. So they have to learn the horse body language and when to get out of the way and when to give up and when to push. And he's got a lot of little nips and bites because he's learning how to be a horse. And the other horses are bossing him around. He was at the bottom when we first brought him home, and that little 13-hand pony would push him around, the little teeny one. And now he's kind of in the middle.
Rudy isn't supposed to still be in Christine Field's backyard corral. In fact, each time Ellen O'Brien drops by to see how Rudy and Christine's other horses are doing, Christine's husband wonders out loud if she's going to take a horse with her when she leaves. Christine originally said she'd be a foster parent to Rudy until somebody offered him a permanent home. But he kind of grew on her, and now he's hers.
They hang out in your backyard, and you get out of bed in the morning, and they say hi to you, and you go down and feed them, and they're happy to see you. And, you know, for us, they're family. They're not, you know, I don't look at them as a means to make money or, you know, to make these great accomplishments in a show career. I just enjoy them for who they are. He's not talking. He's a quiet eater.
Right now, Rudy is a curious character with his nose in a pail of grain, a former athlete who's probably happier than he was when he was running 32 miles an hour around an oval where somebody else was always going 38. Ellen O'Brien acknowledges that not everybody with a big yard and a bigger heart will necessarily want to adopt a former racehorse, even in this season of charity rampant. But that hasn't stopped Cantor from looking for homes for the lame, the old, and the just plain slow, all of whom can still enjoy the non-competitive life Rudy's found in Christine Fields' backyard. For some, the season rings with bells and fellowship prevails. For others, if it doesn't snow, the day of giving fails to give a jot of pleasure, but for some, that doesn't matter. They are the ones inclined to transfer each abundant platter of turkey, mashed potatoes, sauce, and gravy, every dish, into a room not meant for dining. These are folks who wish that every day was Christmas, not for gifts or loved ones near, but just because the tube runs wild with games. They needn't fear a pause. There will be football, oh, a surfeit of the sport, and basketball from every city, hamlet, burg, or port, where teams have gathered far from home to ply their noisy trade. Since sports became a constant, that's the TV world we've made. Don't get me wrong, I may check out the Dandelion Bowl. I'm sorry, Big Bank Dandelion. Hey, you gotta roll with all the punches life can land. I won't ignore the sports, but neither will I be the guy who comes in and reports as he returns to work when all the bowls are finally done that he has seen them all and has not missed a single one. Now, having made that resolution early by a week, I hope I will not come across as some demented freak for not absorbing every bit of sports that's sent my way, for trying to remember that, although it's work, it's play. And in that spirit, may we wish you health and all the rest of all the blessings that can make this holiday your best. Thanks for listening. From all of us at Only a Game. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Splash Studios in New York and from Sam Sanders at VPR in Colchester, Vermont. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about adopting thoroughbreds, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Bengals wide receiver Chad Johnson, who reveals his plan for a very special Christmas Eve touchdown celebration.
There are a lot of deer in the area of Cincinnati, so if you see a deer come out the door, don't laugh.
Coming to network television next December, The Tiger and the Reindeer, Chad and Rudolph's Banglerific Holiday Celebration. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public